Welcome to Friday. Welcome to KOW's Week in Review in Bothell. I've never been here before. McMenamin's Anderson School, not an actual school, but it was Bothell's first junior high school. Can you name a U.S. senator who went here? There's a Patty Murray room that I passed on the way in, complete with cute photo from her time at the school. If you had told me in junior high that my school would be a bar someday, I think I would feel pretty good about that. So we're excited to be here in Bothell, a city with its own reality. It's not exactly King County. It's not exactly Snohomish County. It's non-binary. It's very modern in that way. So if the street you're driving on suddenly mysteriously changes names or numbers at the county line, you're not lost. You're just in Bothell. Less ambiguous is the city motto, quite binary. I saw the sign on the way in, "Welcome to Bothell, for a day or a lifetime." Nothing in between. You have to choose. "Hello, McMenamin's Anderson School. Yeah, I'd like to book a room for the week of July 16th. "I'm sorry, sir, this is Bothell. It's either a day or a lifetime." The town founders named it Bothell, knowing that one day tourists would mistakenly call it Brothell, Washington. The founders said they were okay with that, quote, "as long as they don't call us Woodenville." For yea, truly, that will annoy our descendants. I'm quoting the founders. Well, thanks for having us here. I'm going to see you tomorrow night at North Creek for Music in the Park, where the entertainment will be the band, anyone know? Patitude, a tribute to the music of Pat Benatar. So, yeah, it's a big show. Love truly is a battlefield. Okay, time to hit you with our best shot. Nearest me is the host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel, Joni Balter.
Hi there. Thank you. Good to be here.
Nikita Oliver is a lawyer, an activist, a former candidate for Seattle mayor. Welcome, Nikita. Chris Vance has held a lot of elective offices. He ran the state Republican Party. He's an independent now. Hey, Chris. Welcome back. Last Friday night, former Pittsburgh Police Chief Cameron McClay surprised Seattle when he announced he was dropping out of the running for Seattle Police Chief. That means the current interim chief, Carmen Best, gets another chance to be considered.
I've been a beat cop, I've been undercover, I've been a precinct commander. I know the community, I know the area, I'm a hometown girl, and I want to punch it forward and be the permanent police chief.
The police department, Nikita Oliver, was a big focus of your run for mayor. What do you think happened here?
You know, I think the community spoke up when they saw that Chief Best was not in the running. And in particular, Black community in Seattle, to whom she has close ties, who she's built with and has lots of relationships with. And I think that's actually what started to drive the mayor's office to have to question what went wrong in this process. I think it's incredibly interesting that McClay has still been offered a position. It sounds like maybe an advisor's role. But I think really it was Mayor Durkan, you know, trying to fix a pretty politically problematic situation.
Well, there's a lot more to say about that. Let's talk about, yes, Cameron McClay, who maybe is going to be in some kind of role. Joni, how do you...
Seems like he's, they struck some kind of a deal. I'm not sure who asked who to do this exactly, but... some sort of mayoral advisory role. And so a lot of people think, well, that'll be fine because there is an existing mayoral advisor. And a lot of people think, oy, what a mess, you're going to have co-police chiefs. And I don't think that's the right choice. I happen to be a supporter of Cameron Best as the choice for this.
Carmen
I think,
Best.
I'm sorry.
Yes.
Carmen Best
yes.
is who I'm for. And I really feel strongly that the mayor made quite a mistake here with this process. There were some of the reasons that people mentioned for why she wasn't selected in the first go-round just kind of made my head hurt. So, for example, one of them was that she was local. She was from in town. That is the thing that drives me crazy. Like, you know, many jobs that come open, there'll be like a local person and they'll say, well, of course it can't be the person who's from Seattle. That's ridiculous. That should be a selling point. The other thing was that I heard some folks talking about this. Well, you know, she's friendly with the guild. The rank and file like her. Somehow this was stated as a negative during a time of reform. I disagree again respectfully. If she has the support of the officers, that's a good thing. Why is that a mark against her? I just didn't understand it. And, you know, many of the folks you talk to, they just go, oh, my, what a mess here.
Okay.
And I agree with that.
Chris, what do you think of the mess? Yeah, if you think it is a mess.
Yeah, it is a mess. And, you know, I don't think anybody who is a political observer or active in politics would argue today that Mayor Durkin's gotten off to a very good start. I mean, this along with the head tax, where she took one position, then changed it again, ended up alienating both sides. I mean, she made the pro and anti-head tax crowd mad at her. And now this going back and forth on the selection process on probably the most important person who works for the city of Seattle.
Why isn't that flexibility?
You could be called flexibility, you could be called indecision and chaos.
Maybe you could get a job in the mayor's office because that's fine
and
spin
I think,
on
I
that.
I think this is another example. You know, being an elected official is an acquired skill. And she's a very smart person. I know her a little bit. But she'd never served in public office. And to all of a sudden be the mayor of a big American city with a lot of problems and controversy, I don't know. Politics is a funny thing where people say, I'm not a politician. Well, it's great. It's like walking into a doctor's office, like, I'm not a doctor. I don't know what I'm doing. I mean, sometimes you need to have some training before you become an elected official.
Will you... Help me out. Help me understand, because I don't know how politics works. So what's a concrete example of the big downside of having felt... She wasn't a big fan of the head tax originally. She kind of bargained it down. Now it's repealed. In this police chief situation, the candidates are these until they're these, and then we're going to have a police chief, and then we'll move on to something else. What's a concrete example of how that's going to be a terrible thing?
Because now people question if you go into her office and she takes a position, will that still be her position a week from now? And the head tax was the most egregious example where she was against it, and then she agreed to a smaller version of it, not understanding that those, like the business community who were opposed to it, period, at any level. And then they took a rushed and hurried vote to pass her compromise, which then they turned around and repealed when they got polling data showed that it was overwhelmingly unpopular in the city of Seattle. Look, she can recover from this, but she is not off to a good start.
I think the reality is that Mayor Durkin is actually very disconnected from the communities that most need to be represented in these discussions. When we talk about the head tax, while business community oppose the tax, there is a huge community of houseless and homeless folks and houseless and homeless advocates that worked very hard to get that tax passed because we've done nothing about the affordability crisis or anything about the homelessness crisis. And so when you look at the police chief selection, you see the same disconnect from the most impacted communities. The fidelity of the process in terms of selecting the police chief was ruined from the moment they announced a 25-member selection panel that did not have any formerly incarcerated people on it, did not have any formerly houseless folks on it, may have had advocates who work with young people or people who are houseless or have been incarcerated, but did not have anyone who represented the communities that have been most brutalized by police and were the subject of the consent decree. And so I think part of Mayor Durkin's issue is she's not able to take strong positions on things because she is in her office and being advised but disconnected from the communities that are advocating for themselves.
I'd like to put it in sort of bigger long-term context here if possible. So this is a very smart person. She used to be the U.S. attorney. She's smart, she's connected, she knows a lot. She did have, in fact, a six-month honeymoon, and then the trouble started. Back-to-back backtracks. So that's two of those in a row. And sometimes what happens is your story is written because, you know, it's early in the term. We don't know that much about her. She has plenty of time to recover. But she has to get away from this idea that she makes a decision and then she changes it. I happen to be for the decision, as I said here, for this particular one and for the other one. But, you know, you have to have a way of making decisions where you have, what she actually needs right now is a shark. An earlier mayor had
Tim Cease,
a deputy mayor, who actually could go into the room with the mayor, close the door, and say, no, we're not doing this. Whatever idea you have right now, it's not working, and we're not going to do it.
Yeah, Bill, that's an interesting point, and I don't know. I work for King County part-time. I'm not in the Seattle mayor's office. But the word on the street is she doesn't have anyone like a Tim Cease or any other top flight type political professional who, or with a lot of governmental experience, who knows how to, for instance, get things through the city council. She doesn't have anybody like that working for her. That's the chatter you hear, the conventional wisdom. And really, elected officials need that. Elected officials need their consigliere and somebody who can help them get stuff done.
Nikita Oliver, it's also conventional wisdom, as we've said, that Carmen Best is the more of the insider candidate, that the police union trusts her, are more comfortable with her. I talked to a Seattle police officer just on background who basically doesn't like the reforms being, you know, he feels forced on police officers. We're being treated like the bad guy and we have a disincentive to do our jobs. And he's a Carmen Best fan. Why do you want, do you want Carmen Best in the job?
I do not.
Okay.
I actually sat with all three of the finalists last night. Had a meeting with Not This Time, and I listened to all three finalists make their pitch for as to why they should be the next chief of police in Seattle. And none of them, from my perspective, had an open, honest critique or critical lens about the issues with policing. And none of them, including Chief Best, actually gave a critical critique of the problems and regarding policing in Seattle. While she made a great case as to who she is and how she's worked in the city and how everybody knows her and a lot of people love her, reality is the sort of reforms that need to be pushed forward in the Seattle Police Department require someone who's going to be willing to take a heavy hand. We've had 5 years of the consent decree, and yet last summer, Charlena Lyles was still murdered, and there were numerous policy violations. Carmen Best was a part of the force then, you know? And so I didn't hear anything from any of the candidates. This isn't just about Carmen, but I didn't hear anything from any of the candidates that made me think any of them were truly going to drive the sorts of reforms that are going to make communities that are targeted by police brutality safer. And that's my interest. I live in that community. I represent that community. That's what I need to hear from the next chief of police for Seattle.
Joni, you said you want Carmen Best in the job.
Yeah, so I would just argue that she, you know, she was named by the very popular Seattle Police Chief, Chief O'Toole, who picked her and suggested to some folks at the time that the person she was picking to be her deputy was very likely to become the next Seattle police chief. So that's one thing. And the second thing is that Carmen Best has done a good job in the time that she's been acting. And, you know, if there was some reason not to pick her, let's hear what it is. But I have not heard that reason. And all I've heard from folks is that she's doing a good job. You know, we're on the other side of the court-ordered police reform, so we're in a position now with the court that what we need to do is maintain those reforms and make sure that they, you know, become cement, that they become the changes that we're going to make.
Well, reality is those reforms haven't gone into place yet because of the struggle between the guild at the negotiating table. They've argued that those reforms, especially the ones that pertain to the Office of Professional Accountability, are working conditions. And it's my opinion that in order to get those reforms fully through, we do need a police chief who is willing to stand strong when it comes to the guild keeping these kinds of reforms at the negotiating table. If they don't pass, what we have is we're going to continue to have a gray area where both police officers and community members are lacking protections. So we do need a chief who's not just friendly with the guild, but who can actually drive the guild to be willing to get through this negotiation process so those reforms can actually go into place so we can move into a space of transformation when we talk about policing in Seattle.
Chris, you think Carmen Chief Best has the job?
Oh, I think she has the job. I mean, it just this if after the other candidate took a consulting position with the city to obviously step out of the way, bring her back into the process, if she doesn't get this job, that's good. People are going to go, what the heck? I mean, I think it's an absolute done deal.
Do you see any problems brewing with if you're right, with a police chief and a hired reformer?
Yes, of course. It depends on how they spell this out. If they spell this out that, you know, you're sort of equal in handling this, that is the continuation of the mess. But if they make it clear that Carmen Best is the chief and Cameron McClay is the advisor to the mayor, but that the roles are quite different. Yeah. And if they're spelled out carefully in advance, then it could work. It really could work.
And I think this is where I always do my disclaimer that I always have to do on this show. I don't live in
Seattle. You don't live in Seattle.
I live in Auburn, a place not unlike Bothell, although your downtown's a little cooler than ours right now. But
is it a little cooler or a lot?
No.
It's more
like
than a
every
cooler.
Other what formerly small town in suburban King County. Auburn is redeveloping big time, and it's on the way. But you know what's interesting about this is, all across the country in major metropolitan areas, the police have lost the confidence of minority communities and community in general, and that's very difficult. And I think it's going to be troubling for Chief Best and the mayor that a voice like Nikita Oliver's is not supportive of that. I think it's going to be very hard to pull Seattle together around this choice, or maybe any choice.
Joni Balter with Nikita Oliver and Chris Vance. I'm Bill Radke. I'm drinking an old-fashioned at school because we're in Bothell at the McMenamin Anderson School with a live audience welcoming us. We're going to be right back. Welcome back to the Week in Review from the McMenamins Anderson School in Bothell. This week, Seattle Police Department briefed the City Council on a survey that tracked citizens' feelings about law enforcement. They found that lack of police availability is the biggest concern among Seattle residents when it comes to policing. The Seattle Police Department's Chief Strategy Officer, Chris Fisher, told the City Council that SPD will use the survey of how people perceive crime along with actual crime statistics.
We're working right now to get these raw data into our team so we can start to allow the commanders, the officers, the sergeants, whoever, to sort of really drill down to where they're patrolling and to match it up with what we see in our crime data.
Is there a gap between crime data and how people feel about crime in Seattle?
Well, the FYI guy for the Seattle Times certainly found that certain neighborhoods of Seattle, the big example there was Magnolia, feel more fear about crime than they actually have. Some of that is a function sometimes of...
Why are you laughing, Bothell? Is that happening?
Why are you laughing, Bothell? That's a good question. but a lot of it has to do, you know... It has to do with sometimes with your media diet. You know, TV news is down to cheap TV news. And what's one of the cheapest things to produce? Crime. Crime news is, you know, it's easy to cover. It's not that expensive to cover. And the TV stations, if folks watch them, have a pretty steady diet of crime news. So that increases anxiety, right? Some of the local blogs that folks have, neighborhood blogs, they really highlight some of the issues.
What neighborhood blog is she thinking of? I think you're thinking of Next Door.
Right, but on these, folks are writing about things that you know, they're not like vetted, they're not like reported, they're just things they're worried about, and so one worry leads to the next worry.
Well, some anxious people say there's more crime than statistics show because people don't bother reporting.
Yeah, crimes. That is true. The crime rate is the amount of crimes that are reported. And then prosecuted. And if police just choose not to respond and never report it, then it doesn't get picked up in the statistics. Now, I don't believe that crime is rampant in the city of Seattle. I work downtown. I was born in Seattle. I love Seattle. I work downtown. But let's also look at a couple, 3 years ago, the Seattle City Council had hearings where they talked about there were parts of the city that every once in a while they just completely lose control of. The former sheriff
completely lose control.
Yeah, where there was just rampant, you know, assaults and drug activity. And the former sheriff of King County was quoted, I think, in the Seattle Times, saying he wouldn't let his wife walk alone in downtown Seattle. I work in the King County Administration Building across the street, the King County Courthouse. The Superior Court judges of King County have, I think, twice now held press conferences saying they want more police protection in that area of town because jurors are being assaulted coming into the courthouse. What I find striking, and I haven't been everywhere, but I've been to most major American cities, and you go other places, you see police. You go to New York, there's a cop on every corner. Seattle, I rarely see a police officer, especially just walking. And I think...
Nikita's making a face.
I think people
I see police all the time.
It's all.
Maybe it's because I live on the south side of Seattle where we're over-policed, but we can send a few to Magnolia.
I'm done. It's not entirely a case of the perception doesn't meet the reality. I think Seattle has to look at their approach to crime.
Well, can I just add, I think there's also a little bit of broken windows stuff going on here. In some of these neighborhoods, and I know this is true of Magnolia, not to keep picking on Magnolia, but that it's true that if you see a lot of garbage, if you see a lot of needles, if you see a lot of human waste, you get the sense that things are amiss, that things are not being taken care
and
of.
And one more point, then I really am done. Part of the problem here is budget cuts, even at the county level. Because if somebody is arrested in Seattle, they're arrested by a Seattle cop, but then they go to a King County jail, a King County jail guard, a King County bailiff, a King County judge, on and on and on. The county has had to dramatically reduce all of those positions to the point where only the most significant property crimes are even investigated now. So there's a sense that a lot of relatively minor crimes are just being ignored. Last year, the prosecutor had to dismiss, I think, 4,000 misdemeanor cases because they just didn't have enough prosecutors to prosecute them.
I think reality is, though, so I work with a lot of public defenders. And when we talk about King County Jail, I'm actually told that sometimes 50% plus of that jail is houseless folks who are getting misdemeanors, but they're crimes of poverty. So the answer to Seattle's issue is not really more police. I mean, we have 1,400 already, right? The real answer to Seattle's issue is figuring out how to develop public health strategies that address the root causes of poverty. Why do we have so many misdemeanors? They're low-level crimes and offenses, and oftentimes they are crimes that occur because people are lacking access to resources. If we wanted to decrease crime, really decrease crime, because let's be honest, crime is already low in Seattle compared to many other metropolitan areas, then we would start to develop strategies that get us to a place where people don't have to make hard decisions that we've labeled as criminal. We would actually treat what's underlying, which is the root causes of poverty, addiction, mental health, lack of access to health care, food justice. I mean, there's a long list of things we could be doing to decrease the need for police.
Attorney, activist, former Seattle mayor candidate Nikita Oliver. Chris Vance was a King County Council member, as well as a state representative, And Joni Balter is the host of Civic Cocktail on the Seattle Channel. And just ahead, here in front of this Bothell audience, grab your plastic straws while you can, Bothell. You may not be safe forever. You're safe now. We'll talk about plastic straws, the Seattle ban, and where we're going next with this. Here in Bothell at the McMenamins Anderson School in Bothell. I'll just stir with my finger while we take a break. You're listening to The Week in Review, and we're with an audience at the McMenamins Anderson School in Bothell. Joni Balter, Nikita Oliver, Chris Vance, I'm Bill Radke. This week, Starbucks announced they are following the city of Seattle's lead and getting rid of straws, plastic, single-use, non-reusable straws. Bothell audience likes that. If you walk into a Starbucks anywhere in the world, your drink will be served with what's widely being called a sippy cup, correct. Chris, you're fine with a farewell to straws, yes?
Sure. I mean, plastic doesn't break down very well in landfills. It's made with petroleum products. It's got, I think, a high carbon footprint. We need to take climate change a lot more seriously than this country is taking it. So anything that we can do to move that along, I'm okay with. There is just one little caveat, though. Straws are actually developed in hospitals for patients that couldn't drink any other way. So we need to be able to accommodate people who really need straws. The other thing is, I'm not sure you can get a Frappuccino through a sippy cup. my latte, for sure. But just look, my whole thing is like, yes, this is a good idea, but let's just be reasonable in how we implement it.
Does anyone here have any experience with the adult sippy cup lid?
Yeah, we all do, of course. I mean, when you get the lid that goes on your coffee.
I don't do lids.
You said that before. You must have the coldest coffee. Do you like your coffee cold?
It doesn't need to be that hot. And I've gotten better at steadying my arm. I think I've worked on my muscles or something. I can walk and carry a cup of something.
Can you drive and have no top?
That's actually illegal.
It's really good with raindrops in it. I'll just tell you that.
I don't know what streets you're driving on, 4x4 off-road, man.
It's Auburn, South King County.
I'm doing okay. And I don't really need coffee all the time. It doesn't even have to be that so mobile. I don't have to have it in every spot so that there must be a lid covering it that allows me to have it in all locales. But I digress. I have not tried the adult sippy cup. You're talking about people who need a straw. I talked this week on the radio to an advocate who told me she wants to make sure, and she wanted Starbucks to know, that people with disabilities who need a straw need to be able to get one at a restaurant without having to go ask for it, especially if that has to be to not be challenged, like, oh, why do you need a straw? Mm-hmm. Your disability is not obvious enough to me that I should give you a straw. So, others.
So, if Howard Schultz runs for president, it would be the first, as far as I know, plastic straw presidential platform that has ever occurred.
I think it's the. I think in the early 19th century there was one.
There might have been one. Second. I missed
and
that
he,
one.
And he's running.
He's running now.
But I agree that the plastic straws should go. I mean, all you have to do is take one look at those pictures that you see of that big conglomeration of plastic that's in the ocean to know that we are not doing it right now. We have to change the way that we, you know, use things, like for 2 seconds a straw, and then it somehow ends up in the waste stream, somehow ends up in the oceans. Orcas are dying, the salmon runs are down. Everyone's going to tell me that's because of the blob, I know that. But, you know, the oceans, that's where we get some of our food.
How's a straw ending up in the ocean?
A lot of plastic is ending up in the ocean. And we have to reduce this. This is a smart thing to do to preserve some of these populations of sea life and our own fish that we eat.
Has anyone seen the video of the straw stuck in the turtle's nose? Don't do it to yourself. Nothing you've done has made you so guilty that you have to sit through that video. I watched part of it. I was twisting, and then I thought, I can't do this. I have to go see if there's a happy ending. I have to scroll forward. Not really a satisfying ending to that.
You know what I hope about these straws, yeah, is that it becomes the gateway drug for people to environmental activism.
Yes,
that's very right.
I was going to say.
That's very right.
That might be a reason. Maybe if you live in Seattle, you can let yourself off the hook. But if you haven't banned the straw yet, maybe you should have to watch that 8-minute video.
Maybe. But you know what's happening on July 21st? Young people across the world are actually organizing Campaign Zero marches. It's happening in Seattle. It's happening in D.C. And their goal, and they're young people under the age of 18. And their goal is to inspire people to, yes, get rid of your plastic straws, but to drive them to realize that we can't drink oil and we can't eat money. And that being environmentally being about the environment is actually about our future. And so my hope is that people get so irritated with the straw thing that maybe they'll Google it and it'll lead them to see all the other ways that we can start to decrease the ways that we're harming our environment. You know, a straw doesn't seem like a big thing, although there are communities who absolutely need them, and we have to understand the intersections of need. But how can we get people to start thinking about things that I just don't think on a daily basis we regularly think about? And so I think taking away a convenience like a straw is an excellent way to make people ask a question that they weren't asking before.
That's one of the things I like about it, is because, you know, you'll be reminded, it is a small step, it is. But you'll be reminded about this every time you sort of go into the store and say, straw, and then you go, no, we're not doing that because we're changing our behavior. It has that appeal to me.
And what I like about this is, you know, we're really near the shores of Lake Washington right now. When I was a kid growing up here, Lake Washington was so dirty you often couldn't swim in it. And we cleaned that up by getting people off of septic systems and building sewers. And that's, the air quality in this country is dramatically better than when I was a kid. Technology saves us. And that's what we have to do, is think of new ways to do things rather than taxing people through carbon taxes and cap and trade. For instance, carbon capture is a technology where you can burn fossil fuels and capture the carbon and sequester it under the ground and actually produce energy with virtually no carbon emissions. It's an emerging new technology, and that is a way more realistic way to deal with climate change than just everybody's going to put solar panels in their houses, because there's just it's impossible to get enough energy that way.
The environmental website Grist says when people do something small like ban straws, they give themselves permission to not act on bigger things like climate change and ocean acidification. The headline was, "Is Seattle's straw ban a green gateway drug or just peak slacktivism?" Meaning, it's the slackers' version of environmental activism.
Well, why does everything have to be absolute either or? I mean, let's do all of it. I mean.
Yeah, and I don't think there's any indication that they would just do this and say, okay, now I'm totally done. Don't ask me for another thing. I mean, I just don't buy that.
And by the way, straws get a lot of attention, especially with the Starbucks move, but in Seattle, it's plastic utensils, it's forks and spoons and non-reusables. Now, while we are in Bothell, are you going to load up on untaxed sugary beverages for the drive back to Seattle? Because when one city like Seattle taxes sugary drinks, as Seattle has, consumers can just go to the next town over if a new state initiative passes.
Feeding these guys is tough enough as it is. I definitely can't afford new taxes on groceries. But look at what happened with the huge new beverage tax in Seattle. And other cities in Washington have recently looked to pass similar taxes. Once they reach into our grocery cart, where does it end? And that's why I'm supporting this initiative, before local governments can put new taxes on any of our groceries. Everyone should vote yes on 1634 to keep our groceries affordable.
That is an ad for Initiative 1634 to prevent local governments in Washington state from following Seattle's lead and taxing sodas and other sweetened beverages. Almost all the campaign's funding comes from, this may surprise you, the Coca-Cola Company, PepsiCo, Dr. Pepper, Snapple Group, and Red Bull North America. But does that affect how you view the initiative?
I am so glad that you played the ad, because that shows you that this is a rotten, cynical initiative, really, because this has nothing to do with groceries. The voters of Washington have already addressed that question very nicely in 1977 with an initiative. We don't allow taxes on groceries. This isn't about groceries. It's not a food product, which is what that initiative addressed. It's sugary beverages that have been shown to cause, linked to, further, advance, all of that good stuff, obesity and diabetes.
And yet one of the ads shows a mom and her kids loading cereal, bananas, eggs, and tomatoes into their grocery cart, which again,
it's just
are not being taxed. The campaign is called Yes to Affordable Groceries, and part of the initiative would prevent cities from taxing food, which again, no one is proposing. So yes, it's clever. We won't let government tax you or force you to wear a big red clown nose. Not on our watch if you vote for this initiative.
So I can't predict whether the initiative is going to pass or fail, but I do politics. And the argument of this group is paying for this ad does not move voters. So people are going to vote for this based on whether or not they think it's a good idea. But if the other side tries to say, well, the evil Coca-Cola company is one paying for these ads, that doesn't move voters. Voters are motivated by self-interest and how things affect their families.
I hear those ads all the time, though. The opponents are out of state and out of touch.
And there's a whole and the world is full of political consultants who do things like that, and it doesn't work. It does not move voters. You have to come up with arguments.
What about the term fat cats?
It doesn't.
Also doesn't work.
No, really, it doesn't work. That is not how you win an election. It doesn't move voters.
I mean, I think part of what really bothers me about this is it's fear mongering propaganda, and it's incredibly dishonest and misleading. And it continues to expose the seedy underbelly of politics, and in particular the way that initiatives and lobbying works, that if you have enough money and you can create the right message or a message that scares people and you hide the real details of what you're doing, your initiative just might pass and it could do something very bad. And there aren't a lot of ways for people to get around that without repealing it. And the thing about the initiative system is it was actually created to give voters more power. It was supposed to be a way that those of us who are not legislators, that we can put initiatives forward, go get enough signatures, and by vote pass laws that we as citizens want to have in place. And yet the initiative system has been allowed to be taken over by those who have more money and more capacity and do things like this where they really feed into the fears of people about something as important as being able to buy your food.
Yes, and now getting past whether it's going to work or not, I agree with you 1,000%. The initiative process was created to empower, it was by the populists and progressives in the turn of the century, the last century, and it's turned into the ultimate plaything for rich special interests. I mean, if you have enough money, you can buy the signatures and get your initiative on the ballot. The second thing is this, I agree with you also when you talked earlier about how messed up our tax system is. This once again shows how completely screwed up and bizarre Washington State's taxing structure is. Seattle continuously wants to do things more aggressively, different than the rest of the state, and then people go to Olympia and try and prevent them from doing it. We need to completely overhaul our state tax system comprehensively at the statewide level so Seattle doesn't have to go it alone all the time.
So again, that's Initiative 1634 to prevent local governments in Washington from following Seattle's lead. The initiative would not roll back Seattle's new sugar-sweetened beverage tax. And you are listening to Chris Vance and Nikita Oliver and Joni Balter, and we're going to take this show all the way to the highest court in the land in just a moment, so stay tuned. We're in Bothell at McMenamin's Anderson School. I'm Bill Radke, and I'm with Nikita Oliver and Chris Vance and Joni Balter on the Week in Review, and we're in the friendly confines of McMenamin's Anderson School in Bothell. Hi, team. This week, in a primetime TV event, President Donald Trump announced his pick to replace Justice Anthony Kennedy.
In keeping with President Reagan's legacy, I do not ask about a nominee's personal opinions. What matters is not a judge's political views, but whether they can set aside those views to do what the law and the Constitution require. I am pleased to say that I have found, without doubt, such a person. Tonight, it is my honor and privilege to announce that I will nominate Judge Brett Kavanaugh to the United States Supreme Court.
Democrats were quick to lodge their concern about the nominee, Brett Kavanaugh. KUOW spoke to Washington Senator Patty Murray.
President Trump has said from day one that any nominee he sends to the Supreme Court will overturn Roe v. Wade. And he has said that any judge that he sends to the Supreme Court will overturn the Affordable Care Act and take away pre-existing condition exemptions. So he has made it clear what his nominee is going to do when he gets to the court. And the fact is that if he is confirmed, there will be 5 men on the United States Supreme Court who will be empowered to overturn Roe v. Wade and take us back to the days when women didn't have the option to safe legal abortion.
Is the Brett Kavanaugh choice good news, bad news, or no news? Chris.
Well, it's not no news. I mean, a Supreme Court nomination is huge. I understand. I'm not sure how to put this. Apparently, there was a deal reached between Anthony Kennedy and Donald Trump that they would pick Kavanaugh. Apparently, he is the closest thing to a centrist that you could ever get.
Well, wait a minute. There was a suspenseful primetime TV show where Trump, after agonizing over the choice, unveil. It could have switched at any second.
Right.
I think this reported deal makes it creepier than it would just normally be.
It reassures me that Kavanaugh is going to be somewhat close to Kennedy, who was not a liberal, but not the worst conservative on the bench. But look.
Chris, I don't think the audience is buying that, and I'm not buying that.
The audience is skeptical. Nikita's making a face again.
It's just not working. Sorry, I forgot my faces don't record. You know, I'm just trying to be respectful.
Let me go backwards. What I hate about this is the same thing I think all of you hate about this. Kavanaugh worked in the Bush White House. He's a Republican. People who are known partisans should not serve on the federal bench.
Hey, you're doing a little
right.
better.
But right now, our system is whichever party controls the White House and the U.S. Senate can confirm anybody they want. I think what we ought to do is amend the Constitution to require a two-thirds vote of the United States Senate to confirm judges.
Therefore,
forcing the two parties to work together to find a consensus pick. Kavanaugh is probably the best you could expect from the Trump administration. That may not please people, but it's the truth.
Well, I think you're talking realistically here, but I think there's much to be worried about with this gentleman.
I'm not arguing
about that. And I think Patty Murray, who went to junior high here, said some of it very importantly. You know, Roe v. Wade, you can kiss it goodbye. Now, that wouldn't necessarily affect us directly here in Washington State, where voters at least three times have said that they want a woman to have a right to choose that. But in many other states, people will not have access to abortion. You can see there'll like be, you know, plane or bus trips for people to have to come to the states. There'll be many states, not just Washington, that still have that access. But there'll be like, I think the number is like 20 or 21 that likely would see a lot of restrictions.
But Joni, there were judges considered more anti-Roe v. Wade than Kavanaugh. In fact, when Kavanaugh was being confirmed at the Court of Appeals in 2006, he told the Senate, if confirmed, I would follow Roe v. Wade faithfully and fully. That would be binding precedent of the court. It's been decided by the Supreme Court. It's been reaffirmed many times.
But at the Court of Appeals level,
He came from the list that had been vetted by the Federalist Society and he, the conservative list, where they already know pretty much how they're going
to
vote.
And at the Court of Appeals level, he has no choice but to follow the ruling of a higher court. So he absolutely has to say that to even get to serve in that position. I think reality is this is 100% bad news. He's very young. I mean, not as young as me, but he's younger. And he could sit in that seat for a really long time. So the damage that could happen with various decisions going up to the Supreme Court could last for generations and have serious implications for women, people of color, low-income folks, people with disabilities. I mean, we just saw Janice come down, and that has been horrible for unions. So I think we really have to take this seriously, regardless of how close he is to being a centrist. Even Kennedy made quite a few decisions I disagree with in his tenure as a Supreme Court justice. So I think that while we can think practically about it, the reality is even the practical reality is going to have serious implications for generations to come if he really is confirmed.
Chris Vance, you're trying to get an independent movement going. You're the former chair of the state Republican Party. You want Trump out. How's that coming along?
Oh, well.
Uh-oh.
Little context here. There is a small but growing movement in this country of people who are working to elect centrist independent candidates. There are more independents who filed for the Washington State Legislature than ever before. The governor of Alaska is an independent. There are serious candidates for governor as independents in Kansas and Maine. There's also a lot of people who are flat out saying this is the first step towards creating a centrist third party, and I'm one of them. I think that there are millions of Americans who support liberal policies and the kind of things we heard from Senator Sanders in the campaign. They should have their own party. There are millions of Americans who agree with Donald Trump, but the rest of us need something in the middle. And why is it that this country, as diverse as it is, only has two political parties? I think that's got to change. I think it's starting to change.
Nikita, how many parties do we need?
I mean, I certainly support having more parties. I'm definitely not the person to say that being the party in the middle is the right decision. I think there are a lot of people who suffer when we make centrist decisions, and it continues to perpetuate a lot of harm. So I'm probably the person who's going to want the independent party that's far more left-leaning, but certainly support having more parties because people do deserve to have an option that actually represents their interest.
And well, when people ask, what does this look like? It looks like what I grew up with in Washington State, where you had very moderate Republicans like Dan Evans and very moderate Democrats like Henry Jackson. And that's been our tradition here in the Pacific Northwest. And right now, both parties are moving away from that. The Republicans have gone insane. And the Democrats aren't far behind.
Joni Balter, last word.
So Washington, is, we've often described our state politics as Neapolitan ice cream, one-third, one-third, one-third. And, you know, maybe that'll continue, but Chris, there is not a great record of centrist
Joni,
winning
it's
any
never
major
been attempted. We have not had a realignment of our political party since 1850. Fine. That doesn't mean it can't happen, and I think we're starting to see it happen.
Okay, it's almost ice cream time. We're coming toward the end of our week in review on KUOW, where politics are delicious. It's Neapolitan ice cream and old fashions all night long with our friends in Bothell of the McMenamin Anderson School. Stay tuned. We're coming right back. Coming to an end of another KUOW's Week in Review, I'm Bill Radke with Joni Balter, Nikita Oliver, Chris Vance. This week, Croatia made history.
Mandžukić! Croatia hit the front! Mario Mandžukić pounced! And England are hurt! And Croatia, for the first time ever, will play in a World Cup final.
That second goal by Croatia in overtime against England clinched it, so it's Croatia versus France in the final. Who do we want to win and why?
Well, I wanted England, and I'm not happy now. But
why did you want England?
But I'll be watching. I mean, what's so great about this is I'm 56 years old, and for a long, most of my life, I felt like a freak because I liked soccer. And now more and more people like soccer, and it is the best sport in the world, and the World Cup just highlights that.
So once your team, the U.S., is out of it, you know, you start rooting for these teams for, you know, come on, irrational reasons. And so many in the room were yelling for England. England lost the...
Wait a minute, who are we yelling for, Bothell?
Croatia. Oh, okay.
They were
Croatia.
Happy about Croatia.
All right. Well, Chris is for England then.
Chris is the
And I was Brit. For England and sort of the underdog thing. You know, my dad, whenever he was watching sports, I'd always talk to him. He'd always be for the underdog. He would always be pulling. And so that was, you know, my irrational reason to be for England. And Croatia, all you supporters, Rick Steves once said, Croatia is a nation of shruggers, these people that just kind of like go, yeah, you know, whatever, we'll do it either way.
Huh,
and I went to Croatia.
I went to Croatia,
and I would like ask which is the best, to keep with the theme, ice cream. They go, eh, I don't know. Can I rent this car? Meh, do you really want this car? So anyway.
That really feels inviting to me.
Yeah, it gives you options,
yes.
Choices.
Yes.
We were just talking about choices. I'm for Croatia. I wanna see... Croatia is like 4 million people, and here they are, you know, in the World Cup finals for football, and that's beautiful. And I'm always wanting to root for the underdog. I mean, not that y'all are surprised or anything, but yeah, I think that's really exciting. And just seeing all of their excitement kind of made me wish I could like be a little more athletic, but I'm not gonna try.
Which outcome would create the most net happiness? Like would Croatians be overjoyed if they won, but maybe would France be sadder if they lost? Like what? I don't know.
I don't know either. But a country as small as Croatia has not won the World Cup, I don't believe, since the very first World Cup, which Uruguay won. It would be an amazing upset if it happened. But you know, I mean, in the meantime, we're living through the best summer of Mariner baseball in a very long time.
Absolutely.
That's exciting.
Absolutely. It's always sunny in Seattle, and the Mariners always win. Have you noticed?
Yeah. Maybe we should just talk about the Mariners again. What do you say?
Yeah, they're losing 4-1 right now, though, unfortunately. So.
How do you know? Tell me you're not checking your phone.
He's
on the Week
checking
in Review.
His phone.
I did, for the Mariners.
Oh, my God. How's that possible? When I listen to the Week in Review, I'm riveted.
It's because he has priorities. He has priorities, Bill.
Yeah,
fair enough. That's our show. That's the Week in Review. I want to thank you for being part of it, as always.
Thank you, Bothell. Thank you, Bill.
Joni Balter, civic cocktail on the Seattle Channel. Nikita Oliver was a candidate for Seattle mayor, but she's doing her work as an attorney, as an activist. Chris Vance was the chair of the Republican Party, and now he's promoting centrism.
And independence.
And independence. And you Our Bothell audience at the McMenamins Anderson School, thank you for hosting us. Thank you. And for that second old fashioned. And thank you to the Week in Review team. Amina Alsadi and Allison Bruzek produced the show, which you're hearing because of the good work of Tim Meinig, Sam Roth, and Chris Otey. This whole thing made possible because we have a community development team, Zeki Hamid and Lisa Wang. And McMenamins Anderson School is our hosts. Thank you for that. Thanks one more time. Appreciate you being here.